The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
So quiet. You must be in a library. Okay. Good evening and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Betsy Cohen, and it is my great pleasure this evening to welcome the distinguished author and, after dinner, a good friend and fellow enthusiast of the great state of Maine, Rick Russo. Before we get started, please take a moment to silence your cell phones. I do the little ring that they do in theaters, but I don't think you want to hear me sing. I'd also like to remind you that there will be a book signing immediately following this event, located in the West Gallery on the first floor. Referred to as the Bard of Main Street, USA, and as the Stendhal of blue-collar America, very ritzy epithets, Rick Russo is best known for his novels depicting life in the declining small towns of America. In his first two novels, he focused on the estrangement and melancholy felt by the residents of the fictional town of Mohawk in upstate New York. In his third novel, Nobody's Fool, the action takes place in a similar town. While his Pulitzer Prize-winning fifth novel transported readers to the singular, crumbling hamlet of Empire Falls, Maine. Novelist Hilma Wolitzer has written that Mr. Russo brilliantly evokes the economic and emotional depression of a failing town, a place where even the weather is debilitating, and the inhabitants seem to struggle merely to stay in place. In its subject matter, Bridge of Sighs is not a radical departure from Mr. Russo's previous work. Rather, it builds on and expands on his achievements. "Here is the novel Russo was born to write," wrote one reviewer. "It is a seamless interweaving of childhood memories, tragic incidents, an unforgettable dialogue that is so natural, funny, and touching that it may perhaps be the best of Russo's many gifts. We are honored to have him with us this evening. And so, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Rick Russo.
Thank you, Betsy. Well, it's wonderful to be here. I'm going to read, this will probably be about a 15-20 minute reading, and despite all that, you know, that debilitating sort of stuff, I hope we're going to have some fun here tonight. Even the weather is debilitating, and yet I hope we're going to have a few laughs. The section that I'm going to read comes from about a third of the way through the novel or a quarter of the way through the novel. And because of that, I have to waste probably about 7 minutes of your time telling you some things that you're going to be absolutely mystified by if I don't. And tedious though it may be, this is housekeeping. We must do it. I have a list of chores. Here we go. All right. The Bridge of Sighs is, in its simplest form, a story about people who stay and people who leave. The fictional town in this novel is called Thomaston. It's in New York. And the three main characters in the novel, Lou Lynch and his wife Sarah and the painter Robert Noonan have all just turned 60 years old, but they were all kids together in Thomaston, New York. Lou, or Lucy as he's known because of a tragic mishap in kindergarten, his name is Louis Charles Lynch, and his name is called as Lou C. Lynch in kindergarten, giving him the nickname of Lucy, which he has had all of his life. Lucy is the boy who stays. He's spent all of his life in Thomaston, New York. This section that I'm going to read tonight is from The Boy Who Leaves. His name in youth is Bobby Marconi. He's Lucy's only friend. And he flees from Thomaston, New York at the age of 18. As the novel opens, he is, as I said, 60 years old. He has been an expatriate for the better part of his adult life. He's become a famous painter. He's living in Venice. And Lucy and his wife Sarah, who, by the way, has been in love with both of them at one time or other, Lucy is dreading something upcoming. He's dreading the fact that Sarah is going to be dragging him out of his beloved Thomaston, New York, to visit Italy. And the last stop on the tour is Venice, where they will presumably hook up with their old friend Bobby Marconi. Robert Noonan, he has taken another name since he left. He's fled and taken an entirely new name, is also dreading something. What he's dreading is the fact that he hasn't been back to the United States in a long time, but he's going to have a show in New York of his paintings, of his recent paintings. And he really, as much as Lucy hates the idea of leaving, Noonan hates the idea of returning. Noonan also has a couple of health issues. At 60, he has discovered himself to be the victim of night terrors. He will awake in the middle of the night full of rage and terror, and he hasn't even a clue why this should be. He doesn't seem to be angry at anybody, and he can't explain what he might be afraid of, and yet there he is in the middle of the night, just starkly terrified. And on the other side of the emotional spectrum, equally mysterious, is the fact that he has, in the last few months, been the victim of bouts of unaccountable grief. He will be in public, and suddenly the urge to just break down and sob is upon him, and there isn't a single thing he can do about it except run away and get out of sight. And this has been witnessed by one of the people you're going to meet in the section that I'm going to read to you. But it's mysterious because he doesn't know what he's grieving for. He just feels inexpressibly sorrowful. Noonan has been married many times and divorced many times. He has given up on marriage, but not on married women. At the point that the novel opens, he is involved with a woman named Evangeline Lichtner. And they have been having this affair for some time. Evangeline, she's married, but she says that her husband doesn't have clue one as to what's going on between her and Noonan. Her husband is... Todd Lichtner is... the person who witnessed Noonan's attack of grief. He did duck into a church to get out of the way, but Lichtner followed him inside. Just a few other things you need to know. There's a man named Hugh Morgan who is referred to. Hugh is owns a gallery in New York, and that's where Noonan's new show will be when he comes over to the United States. And he also, he's an old friend. They both fled to avoid the Vietnam War. And Hugh has opened, he has two or three, he's a real arbiter of taste in the art world. He has not only his gallery in New York, but also two or three in other European capitals. A couple of things about Noonan's backstory, too, that would be helpful for you to know. His father and also Lucy's father were both root men when they were growing up. Root men in the sense that Lucy's father was a milkman and Noonan's father was a mailman. The other thing that you need to know is that Noonan's father was a terrible bully. And something has taken place, an event has taken place between Noonan and his father at age 18 that's caused, it's been one of the reasons why Noonan fled Thomaston originally. None of this would matter terribly much, except that in the last month or so, just as he was about to get his paintings all together to give to Hugh Morgan for the show, he has started painting another painting, and he thought that what he would do is paint a painting of his father, whom he still loathes to the depths of his soul. And he's painting his father in front of, there's a painting in the backdrop. The painting is the Bridge of Sighs in Venice. And he starts painting this portrait of his father as a kind of magistrate in front of the Bridge of Sighs. But one day a curious thing happens. As he's looking at the painting, it suddenly dawns on him, and how many of us has this happened to, looking at a portrait of our father? He suddenly notices that the eyes looking back at him are not his father's, but his own. And also, just to reinforce that fact, too, there are very few people who have seen this painting as he's been working on it, but every one of them recognizes it as a self-portrait. Okay. That's enough or more than enough. Oops, that's the wrong page. Sorry, a minor glitch. Okay. "Hey," Evangeline said. She was poking Noonan as one would a dangerous animal that looked dead but might not be. Fully dressed and standing next to the bed, she was clearly prepared to run should the need arise. "Talk to me, Noonan." "About what?" he said, groggily, rising up on his elbows. At the sound of his voice, modulated and sane, she visibly relaxed. Flight would not be necessary after all. So far, she was the only person to witness one of his night terrors. This was now over a month ago, but the experience was still fresh in her mind. Half an hour after falling asleep, he'd awakened in a paroxysm of rage. When she made the mistake of trying to calm him down, he had lashed out, not even recognizing her, really, and punched her in the face, hard. The resulting black eye had been hard to explain to her husband. And since then, they had agreed not to risk a repetition. They continued their sporadic, desultory sex, but when it was over, either she or Noonan went home before post-coital sleepiness could descend. The last thing that she had done tonight before drifting off was to ask him if he felt sleepy. He said no, thinking that he would be able to stay awake, but then fell asleep anyway. "I suppose," she said, "you could tell me what you're sorry about." "I was talking in my sleep," he said. She sat on the edge of the bed now, holding the back of her hand gently to his cheek. "You kept saying how sorry you were. Didn't sound like you at all." "Didn't sound like my voice?" he said. "No, no, it was your voice all right. Just not the sort of thing that normally comes out of your mouth, if you know what I mean. Sort of like Hugh Morgan saying, 'I don't know.' Anyway, I accept your apology, even if it was meant for someone else." Noonan swung his feet out of bed. "I gather you're leaving?" "It's almost midnight," she said. "If you can wait till I put my pants on," he said, "I'll walk you home." "We really shouldn't be seen together," she said. But he could tell that this objection was his to override. As it turned out, they had both the Vaporetto and the streets of Venice to themselves. Even San Marco was deserted, except for the last of the musicians putting away their instruments outside Cafe Florian and some waiters stacking chairs on a gurney. "So when does Todd get back?" he asked. when they arrived at Campo San Stefano, off of which her gallery was located, their living quarters above. "Tomorrow," she said. A failed novelist and turned travel writer, Todd Lichtner was often away on assignment for one of a half dozen magazines. "Speaking of which," she said, "will you see Hugh again?" "It's possible," Noonan said. "I got the impression he wasn't finished badgering me." "Well, remind him that he promised to stop by the gallery." "If he promised, he won't need to be reminded," Noonan said. "I have one or two pieces I'd really like him to see." "The Ponte?" Noonan said. She nodded. "And Gene Nugent's new work." Noonan shrugged. "The Ponte's good. You might like it." "Probably not, though." And he couldn't think of a single reason for Hugh or anyone else to like the Nugent. Evangeline must have read his mind and perhaps even shared his assessment, because when she looked away, there was just enough light from a nearby street lamp to see that her eyes were moist. "Don't know how much longer I'm going to be able to stay open," she said. Her voice was full of terrible resignation. "Some days, I can't even remember why I want to. Most of what I do anymore is just habit, starting with getting out of bed in the morning." Getting into bed with him was another example, clearly, but no need to state that. "People get into ruts," Noonan said. And ruts, he thought, weren't always a bad thing. Maybe an artist's discipline, his routine and process, habit, if you will, were just ruts with a purpose. If you were talented and lucky, they paid off in a kind of freedom, at least within the borders of canvas. Counterintuitive, granted, but there you were. The danger was that the purpose of your regimen would be lost, leaving mere habit to explain and justify itself if it could. And when it couldn't, well, maybe you were done. Going through the motions. Those motions, a feeble prayer that was unanswered, unanswerable. Why had he become a nocturnal walker, taking the same route every night, all five sestieri, San Marco, Castello, Canareggio, San Paolo, Dosaduro? Always that order, never the reverse, gauging time by space and vice versa. In the end, how different was he from his father, whose strict discipline had never been rooted in anything more profound than the selfish need to be in control? "I do love Venice," Evangeline continued, "but it's absurd living here." "Where would you go?" Noonan said. "Yes, well, there you are. What does your husband want?" "Wouldn't it be nice to know?" she said. "If I could figure that out, I could want the opposite." "Try changing something small," Noonan suggested. "Something that doesn't matter. See how that feels." "I've been thinking about doing that, actually," she said. "The small thing I've been thinking about changing is you." "If you're trying to hurt my feelings," Noonan began. "I'm not," she said, tears really starting to flow now. "I'm really not. But I mean, did you enjoy it tonight? Us? Did it speak to you in any way?" The question was fair enough. The exhausted orgasm he had finally achieved, while pleasurable enough, had seemed remote. Something happening on a parallel track. Vibrations half absorbed by the ground, no danger of collision. Was it just age? The law of diminishing emotional returns played out in the flesh? "Glad you came over," he said. Which was true, though it was also true that he was just as happy to return her to her husband and her life. "You want to hear something crazy?" she said. "I guess." She wiped her eyes on the sleeve of her shirt, smudging it with eyeshadow. "Here's what I seem to want from you, Noonan. I want to not see you again for a very long time. That's the first thing. The second is, if Hugh comes tomorrow, I'd like you to come with him." "I think you just summed up about 40 years' worth of my relationships with women," Noonan smiled. It's not a new ambivalence. It's just new to you. Do you want to come up? She said. Now? He said, Christ, no. And then she was gone, the slamming door echoing out into the canal. He said her name, then tried the door, but it had locked behind her. Lucky, that, for he might have been tempted to follow her inside. He lingered a moment on the door in the doorway, then stepped back a few paces to the water's edge and looked up, waiting for a light to come on, which eventually it did, reflecting off the shimmering water and the dark brick walls that framed the canal. A painting, Noonan recognized, and also a memory. A moment later, Eve appeared at the window, reaching outside to pull the shutters closed. He didn't think that she saw him standing down there in the shadows below, but then her voice came down, barely audible. Go home, Noonan. With the shutters closed, the canal was dark again, and the painting was gone. He had just rounded the corner and started to descend the three steps into the narrow calle that opened onto Campo San Stefano when something hit him in the chest hard. Before he could make sense of that, there was the inexplicable sound of coins dancing on the stones at his feet. Todd Lickner's pale face momentarily swam into view, and when Noonan blinked, was gone again. Noonan stepped back, rubbing his breastbone. The pain there, the only thing that he could be certain was real. And then he saw the other man again, gathering up the scattered coins as best he could in the dark and muttering, "What a rotten bastard you are, Noonan." It seemed not to occur to Lickner that a truly rotten bastard might just kick Todd Lickner in the head as he was scrabbling around on his knees. And Noonan might have done just that if he hadn't been so puzzled by the coins. The punch and the simultaneous explosion of coins illogically suggested that his chest had been full of them, that they had been freed by the blow like candy from a piñata. He would have preferred another explanation, but when he tried to form a question, he discovered that he had no breath, that Lickner had hit him harder and with more conviction than Noonan would have ever guessed he possessed. It was all deeply puzzling. And so he sat on the step to watch the other man grope around in the dark for coins that he seemed to think belonged to him. One had come to rest between Noonan's feet, and he picked it up to examine it. Poor light, but he could have sworn it was an American quarter. Finally, Lickner got to his feet and came over to glare down at Noonan with a mixture of anger and, unless he was mistaken, dawning embarrassment. Evangeline had apparently been wrong about at least one thing. Her husband did have clue one. Noonan handed him the quarter, which Lickner promptly threw in the canal. "You shitheel," he said. Still shaking, though his peak seemed to wane as his embarrassment waxed. Noonan's breathing was returning, and with it an idea. Lickner must have had a roll of coins in his fist to heighten the impact, but the blow had ruptured it. And with that realization, the world, which had momentarily tilted, righted itself. "You're home early," he said. His voice little more than a croak. "Since yesterday," Lickner said. "I've been staying in a goddamn hotel, in case you're interested." "Where were you before that?" Noonan said. "Las Vegas." And Noonan smiled, the roll of coins making sense now. He had been playing the quarter slots. How perfectly, Lickner. "I knew there was somebody," he said. "I knew it." He was standing over Noonan now, his fists clenched. "If you punch me again," Noonan said, "I'm going to throw you in the canal." Lickner took a step back. "Hey, I'm the one with the grievance here," he said indignantly. "Nevertheless," Noonan said, still massaging his breastbone, "fair warning." To Lickner, Noonan's resolve not to be punched a second time seemed to limit the proceedings unfairly. Still, there could be little doubt that he would carry out his threat, and so Lickner shrugged and said, "You all right?" "I guess," Noonan said, though he wasn't sure and remained seated for the moment. His breathing was returning to normal, but it felt like the other man's fist was still inside his chest cavity, heaving and flexing. "That hurt if it makes you feel any better," he said. "Good," Lichtner said, offering him a hand. "I'm glad." Noonan allowed himself to be pulled to his feet. "What now?" he said. Lichtner shrugged again, fully embarrassed now. "I don't know," he admitted. "This didn't go the way I imagined. I guess I didn't think much past punching you in the face." "You punched me in the chest," Noonan said. "You were on a step," Lichtner explained. "My timing was off. I guess I was impatient." Noonan went over to the water's edge, raised some phlegm, and spat it into the canal. "I suppose we could go someplace and talk about it," Lichtner said, his hands at his sides now. "The bars over at Campo Santa Margarita might still be open." "Oh, that's all students over there," Noonan reminded him. "Kids." "What the hell?" Lichtner said. "We're behaving like children. We might as well drink with them." He actually seemed disappointed that Noonan wasn't more enthusiastic about the idea. "I probably shouldn't go home yet," he said. "Not until I've calmed down." To Noonan, Lichtner looked calm and then some, like a man far more afraid of getting punched by his wife than he was of punching her. He seemed to comprehend that he was good for about one punch a decade and that he had thrown it not 2 minutes ago. "Thought you were staying in a hotel," Noonan said. "Just the 2 nights," Lichtner said. "If I didn't find out who it was tonight, I was just going to ask her." The bar they found in Campo Santa Margarita was, as Noonan predicted, full of university students, several of whom, recognizable by their outlandish costumes, were celebrating the completion of their final examinations. Lichtner and Noonan took a table as far away from them as possible, but it wasn't far enough. "Dottore! Dottore!" they chanted, while a boy dressed as a penis chugged from a pitcher. Noonan ordered a beer, Lichtner a Campari. By the time the drinks came, some of the latter's indignation had returned. "I knew it had to be you," he said. "I just knew it." "How?" Noonan wondered, curious about the other man's logic. Evangeline, he happened to know, had had several lovers before himself. How had they been ruled out? "You're the only man I know who would punch a woman," Lichtner said. "That's repellent. I can't forgive that," he added, in case Noonan had asked him to. "That was an accident, actually," Noonan said. "Ask her if you don't believe me." Lichtner clearly did believe him, though his resentment was such that he couldn't admit to it. "How about fucking her?" he said. "I suppose that was an accident, too?" "Well, there was an accidental quality to the whole thing," Noonan said, "now that you mention it. It's probably over, if that's any interest to you." "It isn't," Lichtner said petulantly. "It isn't of interest, and it isn't over. Not for me. I'm the one who has to imagine the two of you going at it. How can I stay here in Venice knowing what I know?" Noonan was tempted to tell him that he was just being silly. That if it wasn't in Venice, if it wasn't him in Venice, it'd be another man in Paris or London or Davenport, Iowa. Lichtner's problem, or one of them, was that his wife was unhappy. A condition that, if not universal, was nearly so. She wanted more. More than Todd Lichtner, for one, and more than Noonan, for another. Who the hell didn't? "Maybe you should divorce," he suggested. Lichtner polished off his Campari with a sneer. "You'd like that, wouldn't you?" he said. "Actually," Noonan said, summoning as much sincerity as he could muster, "I don't care one way or the other. Leave or stay. Divorce or stay married. Do what makes you least miserable." "I never said I was miserable," Lichtner replied, his back up now. "I'm sorry, I thought you did," Noonan said. "Well, maybe right this second," Lichtner conceded miserably. "But even I have weathered worse than you, far worse." "You aren't going to tell me about it, I hope," Noonan said. "And it's not like I've been 100% faithful to her either," Lichtner added proudly. "What percentage would you estimate?" Noonan said. Lichtner ignored this. but I've never screwed the wife of a friend, he said. That's where I draw the line. We're friends, you and I? Noonan said. We're not? Lichtner said. It was amazing to watch a man so all over the emotional map. Each new feeling at war with the preceding as well as the subsequent, each important without being satisfying, sustainable, or for that matter even reliable. Noonan couldn't be sure whether he was observing a person or a condition common to men their age. Hadn't occurred to me, I guess, Noonan said. Not that it would have mattered. That day in the church, you broke my heart, Noonan. I really felt close to you then. How close were you, Noonan said. How many pews? Lichtner shrugged, looking pitiful. Hey, you don't want to be friends? Nobody's forcing you. When the waiter came by, Noonan shook his head. A second drink would merely reinforce Lichtner's notion that they were friends, something Noonan was determined to avoid. The other man took out some money. I'm sorry I punched you, he said. Me too, Noonan said. It still felt like the other man's fist was trapped in his chest. You're sorry you screwed my wife, or you're sorry I punched you, Lichtner said. Just sorry, Noonan thought. No more able to pin it down now than he had been earlier with Evangeline. Did you get credit for being sorry if you couldn't explain what you were sorry about? Noonan had spent enough time in catechism as a kid to doubt it. There you learned to diagram sins like sentences, and unless you could explain what you had done wrong and why, forgiveness was withheld. The students were still chanting when they rose to leave. Dottore, dottore, they shouted. Fuck yourself, fuck yourself. A girl dressed like a wood nymph chugged from her flagon of beer, then set it down triumphantly. Nearby, the penis who had been chugging when they entered was now slumped forward in his chair, flaccid. Outside in the campo, Lichtner looked like he might cry. I can't go home, he said. Sure you can, Noonan said. He'd gone out for a drink with the man who had just bushwhacked him because that seemed like the decent thing to do, but enough was enough. Just don't punch Evangeline, he said, because then you will be sorry. That I can pretty much guarantee. Now, the thing is, Lichtner said, I'm not supposed to be here in Venice. My plane doesn't land until tomorrow morning. How about letting me crash on your sofa, he said. It's really the least you can do if you think about it. Noonan did think about it and arrived at the opposite conclusion. Still. How come you don't have a suitcase, he asked. It's in a locker over at the Ferrovia, Lichtner said. Go get it, Noonan said. Go get it if you want. I'll leave the door unlocked. Yeah, right, Lichtner said. Like I can trust you. Thank you. Thank you. Well, we have time, I think, for some questions. And I think I see we have microphones on both sides of the auditorium. So if you would raise your hand and we'll get a microphone to you. Yes.
Going back to an older book, Nobody's Fool. It's one of the few times when I loved the book and loved the movie. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about what it was like to see one of your books made into a movie. And I'm sorry I have to ask, but what was Paul Newman really like?
Were his eyes really that blue? Well, Paul and I have made three movies together now. Nobody's Fool, and after that we did a movie called Twilight, which Robert Benton and I wrote together, and then we did Empire Falls. And Paul has been a great friend and a real champion. I made sure that he got a copy of Bridge of Sighs, actually, just before it even came out in galleys, and he read it right away and called and had lovely things to say. He's He's that rare Hollywood animal, someone who is pretty much what he seems to be. He's very charming, and he's generous, as you would expect from someone who's done something like Newman's Own, donating millions upon millions, and very down to earth. And if you try to get too intellectual with him, he'll let you know. He's a regular fellow, and Joanne, his wife, keeps him on an even keel. As to the question of what it feels like to get a movie made of a novel, that depends on the movie, and that depends on the novel. In my case, I have been blessed. I think the screenplay Robert Benton wrote of that novel was brilliant. I think if you were going to teach film writing to a group of aspiring screenwriters, and you were going to teach the art of adapting a novel, I think you could do far worse than to take that as a model for what it's like to take a long book like one of my novels and take something that's 500 dense pages into 115 pages of mostly white space and somehow leave its heart, its soul intact. I think that's what Robert Benton did in that movie. And to see actors like Paul Newman and Ed Harris and Philip Seymour Hoffman and some of the other people that I've been blessed to have in my movies take on these roles is there are times that just my heart's in my throat. I think in Nobody's Fool there's a scene as a matter of fact, this is an example of what I was talking about before, where a huge chunk of the novel had been taken out. It was part of Sully's backstory. Benton had taken all of that out, and it was a scene with Paul and his son, his fictional son, in the car, and talking about why his son has asked him, "Why did you go away? Why did you leave?" And he's explaining to him about his own father, what his own father was like, what a brute he was. Newman's character says, Paul says in that scene, he said, she was a little bit of a woman and he was a big man, and boy, he could make her fly. And he has this haunted look on his face, and there's a long pause after that. And that was like 10 pages reduced into a phrase, and there was everything on his face in that phrase and in 8 seconds on film that had been contained in about 10 pages worth of backstory in the novel. And I'll tell you, that puts an author's heart in his throat to see that kind of compression, that kind of concision in the service of art. And that's what movies do. They have to reduce. Sometimes they reduce stupidly. Sometimes they reduce tragically. Sometimes they reduce unforgivably. Sometimes they reduce beautifully. And that's what that moment felt like. And there have been many others in between Empire Falls and Nobody's Fool, where as an author, it was beyond anything you had a right to expect.
Hi. I'm a longtime lover of Maine, so I'm just curious why you decided to move there and how living there impacts your writing and inspires you.
Sure. We moved to Maine about 15 years ago, maybe just a little bit less than that, and we did it actually because I was living in the Midwest, living in Carbondale, Illinois. I had a very fine job at the university there, and I had a lot of good friends, but I was dying to get back east. And what I really wanted, I was still teaching back then, and what I really wanted more than anything else was less of that. So I was looking for something that not many people were looking for, which was a part-time job. I still wasn't sure that I could make a living as a writer without teaching, but I knew I could make a living without being a full-time teacher. So, and it just happened that Colby College actually they wanted me to teach full-time, but they were willing to accept the two-fifths time or the three-fifths time that I was willing to do. And that's when my daughters were still young then. They were still in junior high school. Maine was a great place for them. And Colby was one of my better academic jobs. I came and took three-fifths time job and then brought it down to two-fifths and then one-fifth, and then one semester they noticed I wasn't there. And you know, we like it there. We moved to the coast after my daughters were grown, and there was no particular reason to be right there. But I mean, Waterville and Skowhegan certainly were part of the inspiration for Empire Falls for the novel. I wrote most of that when I was there. And the great thing about Maine for a writer is that the winter lasts about 9.5 months. And you can get a lot of work done. I don't know how to choose. In the yes, lady in the black. I think that's black.
Hello. I just want to make a comment about Straight Man. I'm a member of an aging English department at a community college in New Jersey, and I've been there for 38 years. And everybody in the department has read your novel, and we think you must have been a fly on the wall. I think we both love and hate each other at the same time. And I wanted to ask a question about your dialogue, because I think that's what I love about your novels, is your dialogue is just so amazing. And do you say it to yourself as you're writing? Do you ever read it out loud to yourself in order to achieve the humor and the smoothness and the whatever it is? It's amazing.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, thank you for the compliment. Dialogue is and has always been my strong suit. And no, I don't say it out loud. It might seem like that because, you know, tonight when I just read that section from you and I'm doing Noonan's voice and I'm doing Lichtner's voice and Evangeline's voice, it has to read... it has to read convincingly as I'm doing a performance before you. But I doubt anyone here was actually traveling along with the dialogue on the page. But if you were, you would notice that I probably made some small changes. And the reason for that is that dialogue, that dialogue is a representation of talk. But the problem is that talk in real life is a feature of the ear, whereas dialogue on the page is a feature of the eye, which means that it has to work for the eye first and foremost and not for the ear. So when you write dialogue, people often think that if you're writing good dialogue, you're writing realistic speech. In fact, quite the opposite. Good dialogue is the most artificial of all the things that fiction writers do, because it has to make sense to the eye. You can judge this for yourself sometime. Turn a tape recorder, I'm not encouraging you to be Richard Nixon or anything, but turn a tape recorder on sometime when people don't know. And then after you've done this experiment, destroy the tape. And turn it on, and then if you were to type up what people said, you'd find that it was the most unbelievable dialogue you'd ever heard in your life. And that's because, as I said, one is a feature of the ear, the other is a feature of the eye. The trick to writing dialogue really is it's fairly simple. You just don't put much information in. You just let characters' attitude. It's just all about letting characters... What's behind the words that they're saying? Is it fear? Is it love? Is it anger? You just have to know... You have to know what they're feeling when they say what they're saying, and that determines what goes on the page. And it has to go on the page in a fairly stark, a fairly simple way, which is one of the reasons that when you write dialect, when they made the movie of Nobody's Fool, for instance, they decided, I think quite rightly, not to do an awful lot of Maine dialect, not to do an awful lot of Maine-isms. They didn't try to copy the way people talked, because it actually takes you away from what they're saying. And for the writer of fiction or screenplays, you don't do that. You don't do much dialect. You just remind the reader of what the speaker's race might be, or class might be, or level of education might be. But if you dwell on that too much, it just becomes such a distraction that you can't really follow what they're saying. That was a very long answer to a very simple question. But you happened actually to ask me something I knew something about, so I just continued. Yes, in the middle. There are two in the middle. Check shirt.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is a two-parter concerning Bridge of Sighs. How much of your own experiences or your own research in Italy prepared you for this novel? And secondly, what is the contrast between writing from the viewpoint of a character who has a very small-town mentality versus one who is much more worldly or cosmopolitan?
Yeah. You may have to remind me, by the time I get through answering the first part, you may have to remind me again of the second part. What was the first part again? It was the... Was the remind me? The first part was about? First part of the question? Oh, Italy. Italy. Yes, of course, Italy. in one respect, and indeed in many respects, I am a lot like Lucy Lynch in that my life, I sometimes think, is governed by inertia. Which is not to say that I won't move, it's just that it's hard to get me moving. Once in motion, that's the law of inertia, right, is that objects at rest stay at rest, objects in motion stay in motion. Given a choice between going somewhere and staying home, I will always stay home. But about a little over a decade ago, my wife, fortunately, does not see things the way I do in this respect, dragged me off to Italy, to Venice. She said, "You're going to fall in love with this place," and of course she was right. I just absolutely adored it. We've been back half a dozen times since then, staying, you know, for a little bit longer, it seems, each time. But I was no sooner there than I realized that this was a place that I might be able also to use in the story that I was writing. It was fascinating in a way that I was writing a book that it seemed to me, even in the early going, might end up having something to do with not only just destiny, but despair. And we no sooner get to Venice than we go to one of its most famous landmarks, the Bridge of Sighs, which provided me with not only a title, but the principal metaphor for the entire novel, which is that in Venice, the principal court of justice is the Doge's palace, and if you were to go before the magistrate and you were to be convicted, and importantly, if you had no money or no friends or no influence, then you would be sent to the dungeons. And the Bridge of Sighs is the small bridge that connects the Doge's palace, the magistrate, from the dungeon. And if you had no friends or no friends of influence, you would go into those dungeons knowing that you would never come out again. Which made it a very potent symbol for despair, which I knew I was going to be able to use. And also since this is a novel about class, like almost all of my novels, a novel about class, it also had something to say about why people end up on places like the Bridge of Sighs and why they end up despairing and why they end up in a dungeon to begin with. So I knew that I could use all that. And then there was also, of course, the wonderful, this was a bridge, but my novel was already full of bridges. So there was that. And there was just the wonderful serendipity of the fact that all of these people in my fictional town were worrying about the possibility that the tannery, which was poisoning the stream that ran through the center of town, poisoning them, poisoning their lives, poisoning their offspring. It was wonderful that my character, Robert Noonan, had fled halfway around the world and ended up in a place that was full of water and had not only a historical but a literary tradition of being of poisoned water that spread plague. So I had somebody, it was very nice to be able to take this character halfway around the world and have him live, have him end up in a place where everybody's worried about the water. And I just thank God that my wife dragged me to Venice and not Tuscany. You know, I wouldn't have been able to use any of that. And there was another question right in front, about two seats in front. Yes, yeah. Well, we'll just wait for the question or for the microphone here.
Thanks. Well, this is sort of similar. I wanted to know how much the novel you work on affects your interior and exterior life.
I'm speaking into the mic.
Are you a method writer? And in other words, how long does it take you to finish a novel? And does it do any damage to the real people in your life by demanding a certain mindset?
That's such an excellent question, and thank you for asking it. The question is, what does writing any novel take out of you? What did writing this novel do? And I have to separate this novel from my other novels. I would have to say that writing any novel does take something out of you. I've never finished a novel where I haven't felt exhausted, although in the past, as soon as I finish a novel, I've been fairly superstitious about this. As soon as I finish a novel, I begin a new one. And that's for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's just better not to not write. That's one of the things about being a writer, is that it's a, like anything else that you do, repetition is part of it. And if you stop doing something that you do for a living, it's just not good for you. So you continue. Even if you get to the end of something, you start something else. That's what I've always done with every novel up to this point. And in this case, I did not. And in fact, I'm not going to start another novel probably until after the first of the year. And I think that the reason for that was that this novel, and Empire Falls in a slightly different way, my last two novels have taken me to darker places than I probably anticipated going. And in answer to your question, I would say that it's very difficult to write a book about despair without getting halfway across the Bridge of Sighs yourself. And I say that not in the autobiographical sense, but in the artistic sense. I live an absolutely blessed life. I do what I want to do for a living. I'm paid well for it. The people that mean the most to me in my life, my wife, my daughters, are well and happy. I can't imagine a single reason in the world for me to be even melancholy, much less despairing. But I think a couple of the characters in this book were, and I got so close to them that I couldn't help feel what they were feeling. And that's both the very best thing about writing novels and also sometimes, I mean, it's the best thing, and it's also the downside to writing these things, is that, I mean, the best thing really about writing novels is that you get to live an awful lot of lives, right? And, you know, we're all, and especially when you get to be, I'm 58, these characters in this novel are 60. You get to be 60, all of these characters are doing the same thing. They're looking at their lives. They realize that their lives are certainly more than half over. And 60 is not the new 40, no matter what they tell you. You know that you're over halfway. And when you're over halfway, that triggers a certain introspection that you cannot really avoid unless you're entirely stupid. And you start looking back and you start saying, all right, what is all of this adding up to? What does it mean? And all of that. People do that. I think we all do that pretty much. Novelists are interesting because, novelists live an interesting life because they get to do that over and over and over again. We dwell in our own lives, but we dwell in our characters' lives, and it's just a very rich existence. It's the main reason I do it, I think, aside from the money. Yes.
Hi. I've noticed that when you write in the third person, you're very at home getting into the heads of different kinds of characters, mm-hmm. young and old and male and female and blue collar and white collar. But your first person narrators are all middle-aged men. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you'd ever thought of taking on a first person with mm-hmm. Another kind of character, a woman, a child, a person with less education.
That's a very astute and very interesting question. What I find most interesting about that question is that it runs contrary to what I would have thought, in the sense that My rule for first person versus third person is very simple. If the person is very like me, then I want to put it in third person. If the person is very unlike me, I want to put it in first. Now, the reason the question is interesting is that what you were posing was a question which you're saying, all right, you are similar in terms of your age, your gender, those kinds of things, right? Whereas what I'm thinking is, when I decided to do Lucy in this in first person and Noonan and Sarah, the other characters, in third, was that I wanted to do Lucy in first person because he felt very different from me. He's very repressed. He's in some ways self-deluded. He's emotionally conservative. In terms of the psychology of Lucy's character, I wanted to hear his story through. I wanted to hear his voice because I didn't think I was going to do that very well. Kind of in the way, it's kind of the same thing that Edgar Allan Poe is always throwing people off because he writes those first-person narrators about insane characters, and then people read the stories and say, oh, Poe must have been insane. Well, he's the smartest guy in the room, Poe. I mean, and he's not insane. And I think that the reason that he wrote about those characters in the first person was that he wanted to draw closer to him someone that he felt was entirely different from him. And that's always been my modus operandi with regard to choosing how I want to enter a character's thoughts or how I want to tell a character's story. And the question of age and gender seems to me somehow less significant than the emotional makeup of the character. I had a story, the title story in my short fiction collection called The Whore's Child, that was about, again, your idea. The main character in the story was a 50-ish novelist who was teaching at a university. But he was telling, but one of the students in his class was an 80-year-old European nun who had come to take a class from him. She did that because she wanted to tell her story. She'd never been able to tell her story of a child in a convent in Europe to anybody before, and she wanted to get into class to do that. Parts of her story are first person, but the overarching structure is the male professor. Now, I wanted his voice, despite the fact that there are those similarities. I'm in my 50s, he's in his 50s. I'm a writer, he's a writer. He's a university professor, I'm a university professor. But the reason that I wanted to do him in the first person was that this was a man who felt that he had betrayed everything and everybody that meant the most to him. And I'm happy to tell you that I don't feel that way about my own life. But I wanted him in the first person. And the nun, the 80-year-old nun, people have always come up to me and ask me about that story. They always come up and they say, are you the writer in that story? And I always say to them, how come you don't ask me if I'm the nun? Because it seems to me that what I'm after in that story is equally remote. It's true, I'm a long way from being an 80-year-old nun. But what I'm really after is what her life feels like to her from the inside, just as what I'm after in that male professor character is what it feels like to be him. And those are the bridges that I'm always trying to make into these characters. And for me, point of view is just a question of how to get there and what's most likely to work best. But having said that, your question is an excellent one, and I will think about it some more. Okay. I'm getting the sign, which means that it's time to let you go and to sign your books if you have them. Okay. Got my glasses.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.